Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us Dr. Derek Carlson on the line, and we're going to be talking about what's going on in Rhodesia. Now, Rhodesia is a beautiful country, of course, a very prosperous country, prior to the interference by the West. Rhodesia had pretty well done away with most of its problems. It had no policy of apartheid. It didn't separate blacks and white by force of law. Imperfect, because any society is, and certainly a great deal of the land was owned by whites. But of course, the American government guaranteed that if the whites would simply turn over power to the blacks, that they would guarantee the stability of the society, law and order, legal, the rights of private property, the courts. So there was an election, and a man named Bishop Mezeweo was elected. Now, Bishop Mezeweo was a moderate black man, had the respect of a great many people, and he was the initial choice. But we didn't like that choice. We really wanted Mugabe in. Mugabe is a lifelong Marxist, and so we demanded another election. Well, let's get Dr. Carlson, because Dr. Carlson lives there, and he probably knows a lot more about it than I do. Dr. Carlson, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, were you there at the time when, of course, we had them have the second election after Bishop Mezeweo had been elected?
Yes, I was. I was in the country at the time.
Well, what happened at that time? Why did we want to nullify the first election? Was it the fact it wasn't a good election? It wasn't an honest election, or what?
No, the election was very free, very open, really reflected the will of the people. But what you had was the radicals like Mugabe and some of his associates who were completely dissatisfied with that, as well as some of your other radical African leaders who were unsatisfied with that.
So what happened? How did Mugabe get elected then? Was it a fraudulent election that we supervised and brought him in?
Well, that's right. What happened under the promise of the British, who spoke to Muzorewa and promised him that should he step down from being president and have another election, they would guarantee him, according to their intelligence, and that he in fact would win the election. But let's just do this in order to satisfy the other radicals around the world. Margaret Thatcher was then Prime Minister of United Kingdom at that stage, and although she was not for this in her own personal view, the pressure of countries like Nigeria that exerted upon Britain, obviously with the oil and that kind of stuff, forced her to compromise her stand, and she went along with this policy to have Muzorewa step down and another election, which Mugabe then, his military wing of his party, was then deployed throughout the country in a, which was a part of deception, because the agreement was that his forces would be contained within certain areas. But he didn't follow those principles, and he deployed his soldiers throughout the country with AK-47s, putting them in the faces of these terrorized village people and saying, if you don't vote for us, if Mugabe doesn't win the election, we'll be back and we'll murder you.
Now, so basically then, we allowed the Marxist, the communist Mugabe to take power.
Well, that's right, the American government and the British government.
And of course, America was involved as well as Great Britain. Now, my understanding, Henry Kissinger was over there making
right,
a lot of false promises and lying to everybody to convince them simply to give up their freedom, you know, that everything was going to be fine, that he would protect them.
That's correct. And Mugabe took full advantage of that and terrorized the population as he had been doing for the past 15 years. Threatening him that he was the only one who could stop the war. You see, because what happened when Muzorewa was elected, Mugabe's terrorists continued their campaign in the bush, and he said he was the only one who could stop the war because he was the one who was creating it.
So anyway, of course, it's sort of been downhill ever since then, and my understanding is now they're simply seizing the land from the whites. But, of course, what this means is there's nobody to till the land. The black people who worked on that land are out of jobs. The incidence of unemployment among the blacks is momentous. The incidence of AIDS is simply decimating the society. The famine now threatens really millions of lives. Oh, tell us what's really going on and what needs to be done.
All right. What's happening now is Mugabe's position in the country became seriously threatened. His political stability and his ability to hold on to power was under question, because the people really had come to a point where they had decided they didn't want him anymore. He had one card left to play, and that was this line that he wanted to return the land to the rightful owners of the land, i.e. remove it from the black, I mean from the white farmers, and give it to the black peasant.
You mean like his sister?
Well, and his wife and his cabinet ministers. And that's what's happening in reality. But his line, what he says to the media, is one thing, and what he does is quite another thing.
Yes, but doesn't the average black man over there realize that, of course, he is a far worse taskmaster than the white man ever was?
Well, they do. They do realize that the average person realizes they're suffering more than they've ever done in the history of the country. You know, they realize who's the cause of this, but at this stage they don't know how to get rid of him, and he's using his terror tactics and that kind of thing to continue to hold on to power.
But of course, Mabeki in South Africa, who we helped to install, is solidly behind Mugabe,
definitely.
And the people in Nigeria are behind him, and certainly the members of the Commonwealth nations don't have the courage to take a stand. They won't even put sanctions on him.
No, that's right, and you've got most of your African nations around at the recent conference in Johannesburg on sustainable development. They were cheering Mugabe's speech, and Mugabe was given, I think most of the delegates were given half an hour maximum for their speech, but Mugabe, by Mbeki, was given an hour speech.
So much for the United Nations.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it's Kofi Annan is being very silent and quiet, and apparently Nelson Mandela made some ludicrous statement the other day about, anyway, I'm getting off the subject. Carry on.
No, really, you go ahead. You're doing a fine job. Because the tragedy is that here's a country that, until recently, was able to supply food for other nations in Africa. Now it's facing starvation. I mean,
they're
throwing the whites off the land before they can get the crops in or get them harvested. Oh, and of course, then my understanding is that the government there has actually banned any use of a genetically oriented food or genetically developed food just to feed the people for fear it'll get out and get into the general population. What's this all about?
Well, it's all part of the same policy, which is the reason Mugabe is destroying the farming base is so that he can destroy the opposition towards him. And the farming base was a big opposition, not just the white farmer himself, who was a supporter of the opposition, but also the farm worker on those farms. So you see what's happening now. One would think that should Mugabe be driving off these white farmers, he would be handing over that land to the farm worker who at least has a knowledge of farming. But what you find, as well as the white farmer being driven off the land, is 1.5 million black workers and their families. That's the statistics of blacks being driven off the land. Now, that's part of the policy is to break the opposition's ability to resist Mugabe. So part of that is to have the control over the grain, the government has sole control over any grain in the country. So any grain coming in has to go to the government, and they will be the ones who distribute it. So when the United States offered to send across this grain, our government came up with this lame excuse that we're not prepared to accept genetically modified grain. It will spoil our own planting ability. But what we've actually got is a famine of monumental proportions upon us.
But by starving the people to death, he will still intimidate them that they will simply acquiesce to his demands.
That's right. I mean, there's a comment from one of Mugabe's top politicians who, when he was confronted with this issue that 6 million people, which is half the population, was facing starvation, his response was that we would be better off with only 6 million people. So we see it's a definite strategy on his part, just as Stalin used in 1929 and the early 30s to destroy the kulaks of the land. Mugabe is using the same tactic in order to destroy the opposition.
And of course, Chairman Mao used this between 58 and 62 in China when they killed about 4.5 million people.
Right.
Of course, we never mentioned that here in the United States because, of course, we had backed Chairman Mao and brought him to power. This is we brought Mugabe to power, but the average American doesn't understand that. He thinks, he doesn't understand much of anything. But anyway, that's the great problem today, Dr. Carlson, is that the American people have less knowledge of what goes on in the world than probably many of the blacks in Rhodesia. So, you know, of course, but then what about the AIDS epidemic? What's the implications there?
Disastrous. The statistics are that one person in Zimbabwe dies every 2 minutes. That is what it actually works out to. And that age group that is being hit is your middle age group. So it's from your 18-year-olds up to your 30-year-olds that are being wiped out. It's leaving behind a tremendous amount of orphans. It's decimating the workforce. It's completely destroying Zimbabwe's ability to work, to produce, and things like that, as well as putting the burden of all these orphans upon the extended family at this stage.
Well, my understanding, the incidence of the disease in the army, of course, that's the mainstay of Mugabe's power, 50, 60%. Are those figures out of line?
No, those figures are definitely what are being understood to be in place at the moment, yes.
And my understanding is an awful lot of the members of Mugabe's government are dying of AIDS. Is that true? I mean,
there are a number who have died already from AIDS. And then you've also got some who are pretty sick, but at the moment are being sustained with these fancy drugs and steroids and things.
But of course they're not offering those to the poor people. That's
there's practically no medicines in your government hospitals, which Mugabe promised would be free medicine for everyone and free schools and everything. But there's practically in most of your government hospitals there's no drugs available.
Well, now, what about the whites? What's happening to the whites? I mean, have they driven all the whites off the farms, or half of them, or a third of them?
No, there's about 50%, at least, if not 60%, at this stage that are still hanging on. They're trying desperately to remain there. What's going to happen, I'm not sure, however tough Mugabe's going to get with them. time will tell.
Well, now, what about Christianity and Rhodesia? Because, of course, the only way to solve problems, black, white, any problems, you know, is to change people's attitude. And yet, you have these ruthless, brutal people in power that were certainly brought to power by the foreign policy of Great Britain and the United States. And yet, we sort of washed our hands with it and say, well, now that's your problem, after promising the people there that they would stand behind them if they would simply allow the new elections.
That's right. And Christianity is, I agree with you, is the only solution. The church, unfortunately, I think has failed drastically for a very long time to be able to stand up and speak out against Mugabe. If we think back to the early 80s when Mugabe had been in power for a couple of years, he started his campaign of genocide against another tribe in the country, the Matabele people, where, you know, the statistics are between 20,000 and 30,000 people were massacred and wiped out.
And yet, of course, we allow this butcher to go to the United Nations meeting, and where is the call for war crimes tribunals for
Robert Mugabe,
rather than, you know, we're so interested in a war crimes tribunal for the former president of Yugoslavia.
I've never heard one Western power calling for anything like that. To bring him to charge. In fact, if you want a really ludicrous story, you had at the same time when Mugabe was committing these crimes against the Matabele people, he went on a state visit to the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom knew what was going on. They've even admitted to that of recent, that they knew what he was doing. But because of the fear to destabilize the change process that they were hoping to bring about in South Africa, they didn't want to expose this and say, well, you see what could happen in South Africa. They kept it quiet.
Well, of course, I lived in South Africa, you know, in the mid-1970s. It was a wonderful country, and they were working to solve the apartheid problem. I saw a lot of changes there between 74 and 77 as they began integrating the sports teams and certainly beginning to integrate the neighborhoods. You know, it could have been worked out peacefully. It seemed, though, that we didn't want a peaceful solution. We wanted, of course, to bring Nelson Mandela to power.
That's right. That's exactly. This is the same thing with Rhodesia and the change that was brought about there. The constitution that Rhodesia was using was a constitution that was drawn up by the British in 1960, and that constitution was a slow change, introducing people, training them into office, and really it projected a black majority government in Rhodesia in about 15 years. But what you have are the radicals on the sidelines who realize that unless they take power by the barrel of the gun, and if they use violence, they are not going to be the ones elected, because really they don't have the capabilities, they don't have the understanding, they don't have the mindset to honor democracy or anything like that. So they take it by the barrel of the gun.
Yes, but we help them. That's what's so unforgivable, and that's quite understandable. It just seems to be so paradoxical that we talk about democracy and freedom on one hand, and we impose these ruthless Marxist dictators with the other.
Yes, it's hard to understand, isn't it? I mean, it's shameful, really.
All right, fine. Well, of course, now you're a minister in Rhodesia today.
That's right.
And you're just over here visiting the United States for a time?
I am, yes.
And, of course, what is the message you want to get out to the American people, and what do you hope to accomplish by coming on the radio with us and getting this story out?
All right. The main objective that I would like to accomplish is somehow we need to... What we've got facing here is almost another genocide. We've got 6 million people who are threatened with starvation. We've got a horror of torture and beatings going on daily in the country. There are murders taking place. But the famine is obviously a terrifying thing just with respect to numbers and proportions of people who are starving.
Well, now, what about the whites? I understand that some of them have been killed and others have been horribly treated by the government. At least the government has not kept the mobs from doing this. In fact, the government's been encouraging the mobs to really mistreat the whites.
Well, that's right, but it's not only the whites. I mean, he's encouraging the mobs to mistreat anyone who doesn't support him. And they have free rein. The police will not intervene, even if somebody's being beaten in front of their face. They will not intervene if it's perceived or interpreted by them as a political incident.
What about the courts? What about the legitimate courts? What about the military?
Well, the military is pretty much on Mugabe's side. He's got the generals, and at this stage they're all towing the line that he has said. The courts have tried to make a stand, and there's been some very courageous judges who have stood up and judged against the ruling party in favor of the rule of law. Our Chief Justice, for example, last year was threatened, and the government said, well, they could no longer guarantee his protection, because obviously their man was threatening him, threatening his life, and so he resigned. We've had a number of other judges resigning because of this. As soon as someone judges in a way that opposes the government, his life is threatened, and pressure is brought upon him to resign. And when he resigns, he is appointed. The new judge that is appointed is a real Mugabe man. For example, there's a magistrate close to where I live just a couple of weeks before I left who ruled in a case against Mugabe. Well, against Mugabe's policy, let's put it that way. And he was dragged out of the court by Mugabe's thugs and beaten up and then paraded around that town that he was judging and made to chant and shout slogans in support of Mugabe.
Well, of course, how do the people of Rhodesia feel towards America and America's politicians that has betrayed them, and the English politicians as well?
Well, for the most part, the people in Zimbabwe at this stage are pretty forgiving. I mean, if you're thinking about whites who are left, there's probably only about 40,000 whites who are left in the country. And for the most part, you've got people who really don't understand maybe the finer details. They don't understand the things. And for most blacks in the country, Mugabe was seen as a savior, as a hero in the early days, although they now believe that they were completely mistaken. Or at least they interpret the fact that he's now changed radically. And so they no longer see him as that, the majority of them. Obviously, there's some who would still regard him as a savior.
All right. Of course, what do you hope to accomplish? Do you just want to get the information out?
The information out. What we would hope, Mugabe is past caring about what the rest of the world thinks. Possibly a strategy that might work, though, is for the American people to put pressure on their own government, their representatives in that will waken up these leaders to the fact that pressure can be brought to bear upon other African leaders like Nigeria and like South Africa, Mozambique, other neighboring countries of Zimbabwe. Pressure can be brought to bear upon them that they will stand up and oppose Mugabe, cut off their aid. For example, South Africa is still supplying us with electricity that Zimbabwe can't afford to pay for, and things like that. So some kind of pressure needs to be brought to bear upon the other African leaders who are supporting Mugabe.
Well, certainly Mbeki of South Africa is supporting him.
Definitely. He's supporting him, despite the fact that his support for Mugabe is already hurting his nation economically.
And, of course, Neto over in Southwest Africa, and I know that what about the people in Nigeria? Aren't they solid behind him?
That's right. Mozambique as well has given support. Even the Zambians have given support for him.
Well, don't they? Is it simply because of their intense hatred of the white? Is it these are Marxist leaders? Why would they support a man who certainly by any modern-day standards is not fit to rule a nation?
No, it's hard to understand that, isn't it? I mean, obviously there must be a certain agreement with ideology that they have. But I think there's also this racial card that is being played and to quite an extent, where there's this we couldn't care less. There's also a misconception about the land policy. You've got a misconception flowing throughout Zimbabwe, and I think it continues throughout most of the African countries about the land issue. You know, the Zimbabweans somehow give the impression, Mugabe and his cohorts, that the land issue began in 1890 when the pioneer columns came up there, Cecil John Rhodes and people like that, to take the land. But the reality is that the Shona people, who is basically the tribe that Mugabe is from, they came up into that area and decimated and destroyed the people who were there before them. After them came the Matabele people, who then subjugated the Mashona people and took their land and treated them like animals. So when they talk about giving the land back to us, it's our land. You know, it's not based on reality. It's not based on fact. It's just based on a presumption, on a statement that is just a complete fiat statement. The land belongs to us, and we're taking it back.
Well, of course, didn't Mugabe's people slaughter a lot of the Matabeles, who were actually Zulus?
That's right. He kind of got his own back when he came to power, and they annihilated some 20 to 30,000 people.
And, of course, nobody ever talks about the slaughter of the Matabeles. That's sort of a forgotten issue.
That's right, and nobody even holds him accountable for that. Nobody's questioning him. Nobody's even judging him on that. Forget about what he's done of late. Forget about how he's cheated in the elections, how he's murdered so many people. If you just go back to the early 80s, he was already disqualified as a legitimate leader due to his genocide.
Well, some of the material that was sent to me by the people who scheduled this program came from Peter Hammond, who we sat on our program many, many times. Do you know Peter?
I know him very well, yes.
And is he working with you, trying to bring some sanity to your...
We network as much as we can and work together, yes. He has a great ministry in that sense. He's done some writing as well to try and bring attention and awareness of what's going on in the country.
But isn't it dangerous, as you do, to speak out against the authoritarian and ruthless and tyrannical rule of this man?
Is it dangerous to do that?
Yes.
Yes, it is, because people who oppose Mugabe are singled out. And, you know, he has a very ruthless secret police who really have no scruples. They're very well financed and equipped. And they do his dirty work for him without a blinking an eyelid.
And of course, do they sometimes kill their political opponents?
Oh, definitely. That's routine. That's not even a rare thing at all. It's constantly happening.
Well, have they killed very many of the whites there?
There have been a number killed. I think, in many respects, what prevents them from killing a lot more is the fact that often whites in the country would have connections outside the country, and it becomes a lot more high profile when a white person gets killed. So in a sense, he's a bit apprehensive. Well, he has been up to this point. But yeah, I mean, he has talked clearly about his hatred for them. I mean, I can give you some statements that Mugabe has made. I mean, he even speaks against the blacks. He said that, you know, to you who support whites, we say down with you. He's talking about the blacks. He has said basically that whites are second or third class citizens in Zimbabwe. He has said that the only good imperialist, and what he's talking here in the context is any white person, you know, basically the whites are all imperialists unless they support him. He says the only good imperialist is a dead one. So he's made some really outlandish statements.
You know, when I lived in South Africa, I never felt any animosity of the black towards the white. In fact, I was there during the Soweto riots, remember, in 1977, and I was called to the black hospital where I worked in the middle of the night, and it was Soweto was burning, and there was talk of riots in our town, and I was a little apprehensive going to this hospital because it was all black. But, you know, when you get a call and you're a doctor, you go. And I had to walk down a hallway, maybe 100 yards, with people sleeping on both sides, and nobody there at all. And I suddenly realized they were looking to me for security. They had no animosity towards me as a white man.
Right.
You've lived there. What is the feeling of the black towards the white?
Well, I mean, if in Zimbabwe and Rhodesia, the attitude of the black towards the white, as a whole, was even better than it was in South Africa. People would even remark that, you know, in Rhodesia or in Zimbabwe, there was a much better race relationship than you know, even in South Africa. So what you've got now at the moment is Mugabe stirring up the racial hatred. He's using the race card. He's focusing the destruction, the chaos in the country, the hardships, the suffering, upon this minority of white people, 40,000 out of 1.5 million people, and he's saying that these are the cause, this is the reason of our trouble. If we get rid of the white man, if it's the white man who's giving the problems, the reason the people are suffering is because the blacks haven't got land and the whites have got it all.
Now, how many are people in Rhodesia altogether?
12.5 million.
12.5 million, and so there are 40,000 whites and 12.5 million people?
That's right. So, I mean, the proportion there is what? A 0.something percentage of the population is white. And Mugabe is blaming them for a lot of the stuff, a lot of the trouble. And he's you know, the state media at the moment is increasingly volatile with respect to its racial rhetoric, and the songs and the interviews and the stuff that is being done is is all geared at stirring up the racial hatred. And one does feel, to a certain degree, that the racial tension now is worse than it has ever been because of the state media. If you remember, Rwanda did the same kind of thing before its genocide stirred up the
You're talking about before it's when they actually killed the one tribe.
Yes.
There was the Tutsi, I think, was the tribe that were killed there. About 800,000 of them, while Kofi Annan refused to allow the United Nations forces to come to their aid, and they simply slaughtered them with machetes.
That's
and
right.
Kofi Annan, of course, said, no, you cannot come to their aid. So, here is a man, Kofi Annan, who supposedly represents the black, and yet he seems to serve a far different master. It has nothing to do with race. He allowed those people to be killed. And, of course, part of that, I think that they were predominantly Christian, weren't they? They were Catholics?
Yes, that's right. And, I mean, you see the same thing in Zimbabwe. I mean, how can any black leader support Mugabe when the suffering is incredible for the black people in Zimbabwe at the moment? And you know, if you're talking about 40,000 whites, if 6 million people are facing starvation, that's black people who are going to die, who are dying already. And yet these African leaders are prepared to stand and support this man. It's just unbelievable.
Well, we're going to have to take a break here. And when we get back, of course, we're going to invite our listeners from out across America or from the Great Northwest, where this is being broadcast, to give us a call at 464-8295 or up there in Washington across America, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Give us a call. Let us know what your thoughts are on what we're talking about tonight. And our guest this evening, Dr. Gerald Carlson, who's a minister there in Rhodesia, really almost literally risking his life to speak out here on Radio Liberty tonight. Well, this is the time when I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who are calling or who are willing to join us in this effort to educate people. There are a lot of things going on that you're not going to really learn about, or if you do hear about them once on the radio, your attention will never be focused on them, because the reality of the American people is being manipulated just as the reality of the Rhodesian people is being manipulated. In Rhodesia, of course, you have your state-controlled media. Here in the United States, you have your CFR-controlled media. And, of course, when you try to get a story out that doesn't go along with the official party line, why, it's squelched, as a recent program by Connie Chung to discuss the Skull and Bone Society, which our president belongs to. It's a secret occult society with origins in the Illuminati. And Connie Chung had the program all ready to go on CNN, and somebody just pulled the plug. You're not to hear that sort of thing, that certain things the American people aren't going to know. Well, here on Radio Liberty, we'll tell you what's really going on. We'll tell you about the spiritual battle that's being waged for the hearts and minds and souls of men, because behind everything going on are these spiritual forces. And what we described during the first half of this program is simply organized evil. And when you understand this organized evil, then it really begins to make sense, because if you're looking for any logic to this, why, there is no logic there. When you try to analyze the great wars of the last century, they don't make sense unless you understand that this was evil, and it was organized evil. And during the last 2 years of the Second World War, 1 million people were dying every month. And time and again, when the Allies could have stopped the war, of course, they chose to continue it. 1 million people, 1 million human beings dying every month. And, of course, we'll see even probably far worse things in Africa, and perhaps even right here in America before too long, because, of course, men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. Our job is to speak out, to reveal what's going on, to be the watchman on the wall, described in Ezekiel 3 and 33. And if you want to join our effort, because we do have a voice now heard on about over 50 stations every week, a small, maybe a lot of them are just half an hour a week, but at least we're heard there. And people are hearing the truth that they would not have the opportunity to otherwise. And I can't make people listen, but if I put the message out there, I believe that God is going to cause certain people, for one reason or another, to turn into the programs. And perhaps their view of the world, whether they're Christians or not, will begin to change as they begin to understand what's really going on today. And so if you'd like to join our effort It's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we truly are at war today. America, our future, our values, our families are under attack today. Well, Dr. Stan back here, and our guest is Dr. Derek Carlson, and of course he is from Rhodesia. What city is your church in, Dr. Carlson?
In Mutare.
Mutare.
City on the eastern border with Mozambique.
Okay, fine. And if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment for Dr. Carlson, who of course lives in this this tragic nation today, where well over 25% of the adult population is HIV infected. And when you take, of course, the young people, you're probably talking, 40% of them? What do we know about the incidence of the disease, HIV infection among those, say, between 15 and 30?
Yes, it's in that ballpark, definitely. It's all going to die.
One of the greatest tragedies of all time. And what? How are we fighting it? Why, we're telling them what you need is more sex education, and we're going to pass out the condoms, and if you don't do what we say, why, we're not going to give you any more foreign aid. And I'll tell you what, if I was a doctor and 50% of my people were going to die, why, they'd pull my license. But for the public health authorities, they have a failed public health policy, and how do we treat them? Why, we give them more money to continue the same public health policy. So, hey, there's certainly only one of the problems facing Rhodesia today, Zimbabwe. And, of course, the other problem is imminent starvation. How soon is this really going to strike, or is it already there, Dr. Carlson?
It's already there in certain places, and really we're talking about some months now. The wheat reserves are reported to going to be expended by the end of this month, which has now become pretty much a staple. Maize is the staple diet usually, but that has been in short supply now for many, many months. So people have been relying on bread, and even that is starting to fail. So it is in some of the more rural areas, there's people already starving.
We've heard that even someplace people are selling their children for food for the rest of the family. Is that true? Have you heard that?
I haven't heard that, but, you know...
I just heard this on the radio today, and I thought of you when I heard it reported. And of course, you never know what... I never believe anything I listen here on the radio, unless perhaps it's on Radio Liberty, our program. But and then, of course, we have to even question everything there. We always try to get guests on who are responsible in giving us the right information. But once in a while, of course, we are mistaken, or people, our guests, are mistaken. But certainly you're living through this terrible, terrible tragedy. And Rhodesia really was sort of a jewel on the continent of Africa, and prosperous, exporting food. The living standards for the black man were improving. The health standards for the black man were improving. The educational standards for the black man were improving. And, of course, it's all been lost, hasn't it?
That's right. It's devastated now. And, I mean, they're talking about the damage that is being done now, even daily. And the compounding factors is talking about generational damage. You know, it's not going to be able to be fixed in a short time at all. So it is really pulling out the roots, so to speak, of the whole of society.
Well, now, how many of the whites have just picked up and left and say that, you know, just going to give up their farms and give up everything and give up their life? Because many of these farms have been in the families for generations.
That's right. I mean, you've got farmers who have been farming that land. Their family's been farming it for 100 years and more. And many of them, they've just been forced off. There's nothing more they can do. They've just lost everything, because not only have they been forced off, many of them also had all their property within their houses and their farm equipment looted. So there was, you know, a lot of them are really destitute.
So are they leaving the country? What are they doing?
They're trying to. A number have left. The ironic thing is that you've got other national nations like Zambia and Mozambique asking these white farmers to come and farm in their countries, because they are good farmers and they're trying to make themselves prosperous. So it's ironic, like you mentioned earlier. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense, because it's sinful. It's wickedness. It's evil.
Well, when you recognize that, the only sanity that there is, you know, is this organized evil that seems to have gripped the very heart of Africa. And, of course, I understand that the people over in Mozambique have even invited a lot of the Boer farmers from South Africa to come there to begin producing so they'll have enough food for their people to eat.
That's right. They've done that and try to make attractive offers for them to come and farm the land in that country. And yet, at the same time, these same leaders are supporting Mugabe's position. Do you understand? I mean, it's...
All right. Well, anyway, about what percentage of the whites have left?
Well, it depends when you're talking of. I mean, if you, you know, when you think of the statistics of down to 40,000, and you're thinking of, 100,000, 150,000 people that were in the country, we're not just talking about farmers. We're talking about all kinds of talents and qualities, you know, that they had, skills. So we're talking... more than half the population of white has left.
All right.
We've also got a huge black population, middle class, that has been pouring out the country as well.
Well, where can they? Where will the blacks go? I mean, you know, the whites at least can go to Great Britain, or maybe if they're fortunate, they can go to Canada or here. But where do the black men go?
You've got a lot of black folks who are going illegally into South Africa, huge amounts. You've also got a lot of black folk who are going into Europe and in fact, into the United Kingdom, funny enough, and working there.
At least they can get out, you know. Of course, the lower-class blacks with very poor education are trapped in there. There's no place they can go.
That's right, yes, they're stuck. There's practically nothing they can do, and probably the economic position at this stage is such that they're not even going to be able to get out if they could, with, you know, respect to buying a bus ticket or something like that. South Africans are very mobilized, their military along their border to stop Zimbabweans crossing illegally into South Africa. So it's quite a mess and quite a scary situation for those people who are facing starvation. The government is controlling who's getting food in many of these areas and preventing it from going to people who have supported the opposition. And obviously by their voting, many people have supported the opposition. So the government is starving out these people as well.
And you're going to starve them to death, really. Now, is Christianity growing in Zimbabwe at this terrible, terrible time?
You know, there has been a definite a move by people. Pastors will tell you, you know, people have been much more interested in this, in Christianity and coming to church and things like that. We have a profession of Christians in the country is 70%. That's what the statistics will tell us of people who would profess to be Christians.
Now, is that black, white?
That's everybody.
Okay.
So it's obviously, you can see the numbers of blacks who are included there. It's a massive group of people. But at the same time, you've got a population of 70% professing Christians who continue to allow, or have done for decades, a dictator like Mugabe to remain in power.
But of course, I don't know if they preach the gospel of Romans 13 in Rhodesia, but that's the gospel they preach here, and they say it doesn't matter how wicked the ruler is. If you're a Christian, you've just got to obey the government, because that's what Paul told the Christians back, in ancient Rome. And so Christians should never stand for anything. They should just do whatever the oppressive government tells them. I don't understand this gospel, but that seems to be what's being preached today here in America. Do they preach that in Rhodesia as well? Is that what neutralized the people to allow this evil to simply engulf the society?
That's right. Unfortunately, the same message has been preached there. So you've got a church that doesn't really understand its responsibilities when it comes to talking about justice in the civil realm. You've got a church who is even afraid in many respects to speak out. Even with the massacre in the 80s, many churches remained silent. The majority of churches were silent about that, mainly because probably it didn't affect them. And now you've got something that's affecting them and their people, and yet they're still not prepared to speak out. You've got many ministers who, before the presidential election in March, for example, would say things like this. They would say that, in my congregation, I've got supporters of both parties, of opposition and of Robert Mugabe, and therefore I'm not prepared to make a stand and say, you know, who's just or who's not or anything like that. So, in a sense, the pastors were afraid to point out what is immoral and what is evil and call it by its name, and exhort their flock that to vote for such a man is immoral. It's not a neutral decision. It's not something that you can just decide whether you want what you want for breakfast. It's not a cereal that you're choosing. This is a matter of morality. And yet many of the pastors did not realize that, and therefore they did not speak out.
Well, it sounds to me like a lot of them have more fear of government than they do of God.
That's not exactly what it is. People are afraid of what Mugabe can do to them. They love their lives more than they love the truth and things like that. And once you have that, once you have a concept that liberty is something that can be cheaply earned and cheaply maintained, really you've lost it already.
Well, you know, with a nation that is 70% Christian, that society should reflect the church.
That's
and
right.
If your society reflects the church, then your church is sick.
That's right, yes.
And of course, but you're willing to speak out, and you're going to be going back over there, into this this situation. Have you ever thought about just picking up and leaving?
Yeah, it has crossed my mind.
I think it crosses everybody's mind, but what are you going to do?
Well, we believe, we want to be faithful to the Lord where He would have us minister, and we believe He would have us minister there until He directs us elsewhere or until He clearly, closes the door to that. We believe that's who we are to be ministering. You know, we've built up a congregation, we've built up a newsletter audience who, I write a News Time paper which deals with relevant issues like these, trying to bring a biblical perspective to such issues. I've written papers on like Romans 13 and things like that to try and educate the church. So there is a certain amount of people who are following that. Obviously, it's still very small in the sense of the majority line. But until we cannot be effective any longer, we believe we need to remain there and continue proclaiming the truth.
Well, that's, of course, why I stay in America. I think everybody at one time thinks, I'd like to run away, but I believe the battle for the survival of the world really rests upon the direction America takes. America brought this terrible, terrible tragedy, along with its ally, Great Britain, to your country and so many of the other countries. And as long as America continues doing these things, why, somebody has to speak out against it. And as long as we can, I believe that's what we're called to do. Do you have access to the internet there in Rhodesia? Do the
yes.
people there have computers?
It's a very small percentage of the people have access to the internet and computers, but they are available.
Well, if you would mention our website, radioliberty.com, where they can either listen to or link to our programs 5 hours a day as we try to speak out across the world and try to get people to understand that behind everything going on today are spiritual forces. There is no other logical explanation. And, of course, we have done a great deal of research. The reason I went to Africa and lived in South Africa in part was I wanted to, of course, study Cecil Rhodes, because Cecil Rhodes was a pivotal figure, not only what happened in Africa and Rhodesia, but what happened in England and the United States. And, of course, that led me into an understanding of what motivated Rhodes and what motivated the people who followed him. So, I hope that you can get some of the people over there to listen to. It's simply radioliberty.com, and maybe we can, have some sort of communication back and forth and at least help the people who understand, to some extent, the true spiritual nature of the battle in which we're currently engaged.
Yes, definitely. I'll promote that as much as I can. We also have a website.
Well, please give that out, and we want to know what the listeners to this program could do to help you and the people over there, both black and white, who really face such terrible, terrible times.
Okay. Our webpage is ZimHope.
How would you spell that for us?
ZimHope.
ZimHope, okay.
ZimHope.org.
All right, zimhope.org, right?
That's right. That's our website, www.zimhope.org.
All right, fine. And then, of course, what can people do? Is there anything that people can do? They can pray for what's going on over there, but I feel we'll be having enough problems here very, very soon that, my fear is as we move into this the coming war in the Middle East, that there's going to be a dramatic change this year. But what can people do? Pray for what's going on over there? What else could they do? Is there anything else they can do?
We can pray, I think, as well, if they're involved in, you know, contacting their representatives, their senators, and whatever, how the whole system works here, and just making them aware that the American people are aware of what's going on, and that this is, you know, a genocide that is impending, that is hanging over the nation, and it's completely immoral for them to put pressure on the surrounding leaders. I think that's one thing that they could do. We also have a literature ministry providing Christian literature for people back in Zimbabwe. I've written two commentaries to help address the great need for literature in our country. And we have that, one of them is translated into Shona language, if people are interested in supporting a literature distribution, because as we know, it's really, in the long term, it's only Christian teaching and understanding that is going to promote and deliver us from the clutches of evil and help us to stand against evil. So, you know, literature is really an effective way of doing that, so we're trying to promote that. If people are interested in being involved in literature in some way, they could contact us and talk about it as well.
And of course, I contact you then through your webpage, which is zimhope.org.
That's right.
All right, fine. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience, at our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And, you know, having lived in Africa, you know, most people imagine, you know, the jungles and Tarzan, and yet, of course, the land there is very much like the land here, and the cities were very much like the cities here, perhaps a lot more black people there, but well-dressed, many of them, most of them were, you know, educated, at least had semblance of an education. Some of them were very well educated, university people, you know, they were teachers and they were lawyers, and there was all sorts of opportunity for the black man, I know, in South Africa, and I'm sure it was probably even more so in your country, wasn't it?
That's right. It has been very, very, you know, open and stuff for people to advance and get on, and really Mugabe has taken the wheels off it now, in an attempt to hold on to power. So
what's happened to the universities there?
You've got a couple of things taking place in universities. One is the university students are quite opposed to Mugabe. So in many respects, there's been great oppression on them in the sense of shutting down the universities, because what Mugabe is afraid of is an uprising of these students and creating problems. So he's been very ruthless in the way he's dealt with the universities. Obviously, these are thinking people in the universities, and they realize that he is the cause of the problems over there. So the universities have been pretty much clamped down on. There's still some education going on in some of them that have decided to remain politically neutral, so to speak. So it's a bit of a mixed bag.
Now, what about the medical care? You mentioned that there just weren't many medicines. At one time, Rhodesia had a very advanced medical system. I know when I was teaching at the University of Orange Free State in Bloemfontein, South Africa, we would have doctors come down from the hospitals there. And I think, was there a medical school in Rhodesia? I think
there was. It was a very, very well-renowned medical school. And in fact, we had one of the best pediatric hospitals in the world as well. What's happened now is you've got such shortages in the hospitals that there's practically no drugs available in your, particularly talking about your government hospitals. You do have some private hospitals, but also very short on that, and the price of them is just prohibitive for most people to get access to. But the government had promised free medication and things like that, but there's huge shortages. If somebody in your family and is admitted to a hospital, the family members have to cook food and take it to him and look after this person in the hospital. It's just a complete breakdown in many respects.
I think that's very difficult for people here in the United States to imagine a situation like this, where you've got a relative in the hospital and you've got to take them food because there's no food there.
That's right, yes.
And of course, I know in other countries you have to almost bribe the medical staff to get medical care. Is that the case in Rhodesia, or is that not true?
Bribery is very rife throughout most ranks. You know, throughout your entire civil service, throughout your police, and things. Bribery is a huge thing. That's how these people make their money. So whether you're applying for a teaching job or whether you stopped at a police roadblock, there's going to be bribing going on to one degree or another.
Because the government doesn't pay high enough salaries. The only way that the government officials can live is by taking bribes. Is that pretty well how it works?
Pretty much to say, what you've got is the inflation rate that is is just, you know, outstrips any increase they might get of salary increases. So inflation rate is well over 127%.
127%?
Yes. I mean, for example, I'll give you an example. Your packet of potatoes, which a sack of potatoes, which is what, about 30, 40 pounds, I'm not sure how much that is in your weight, but it went up in the last 2 weeks from 1,000 Zimbabwe dollars for a pocket of potatoes to 3,000.
Well, now, how would a Zimbabwe dollar pay compare with an American dollar?
Well, that depends, you see, because what our government has done is set the exchange rate. They fixed the exchange rate for a Zimbabwe dollar and an American dollar, and the exchange rate is 52 to 54 Zimbabwe dollars for one U.S. dollar. But in reality, the rate is 700 and up for a Zimbabwe dollar to an American dollar.
So basically, though, if it's gone up from 1 to 3,000 dollars, why, you're talking about $21 for a sack of potatoes or a bag of potatoes?
At the government-controlled rate, yeah.
Okay. I mean, that's just unbelievable.
Well, that's right. And when you compare that to, say, your minimum wage, which would be in the region of $2,500, $3,000, you see what actually how people are struggling to survive, where they would be able to buy a pocket of potatoes for a month's wages.
So you get $2,000 to $3,000, which is equivalent of how much in American dollars, and realistically?
If that's your minimum wage. So I mean, it depends what you're talking about. You know, that would be like the bottom of the rung person who's working.
Right.
But if you're talking, say, teachers, for example, who would be earning in the region now of 25, say 30,000 Zimbabwe dollars. You know, in real money terms, when their money is converted at the black market rate, you know, you divide that by it's something like what, $30, $40 a month, U.S. dollars.
And of course, from a prosperous nation, you know, where people were living comfortably to where they are today, is a direct result, I believe, of American and British intervention in the affairs of another nation. But then, why should we be surprised? We're going to go to war over in Iraq because we don't like Saddam Hussein, and I'm sure we're going to take out the Iranian government and the Syrian government, and because we don't like their government. And yet, of course, people have forgotten, of course, we helped Saddam Hussein, and we brought the Iranian government to power. Well, that's another subject for another evening. Dr. Carlson, we're just about out of time. What is the message you would like to leave with our listeners tonight?
I think the American people need to realize that liberty is something that is very precious and something that needs to be vigilantly guarded and looked after. I agree with you. I think America is a very significant player in the whole missions base, in the whole thrust of Christianity in the world, and they've played a significant role in the history of the church, in the history of Christ's kingdom, and they will continue to play that part, but only as long as the church here in this country remains vigilant and loves justice and is courageous as well to speak out, to stand against that which is evil. And it requires self-sacrifice, it requires courage and things like that. So if that is lost, in many respects, a great bastion of Christianity will also be lost.
Well, thank you so very much for being with us this evening. Our guest has been Dr. Derek Carlson, and of course his web page is www.zimhope.org. And if you'd like to get in touch with him, that would be the way to do it. God bless you, Dr. Carlson. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll be looking forward to having you on our afternoon program next a little later this week, and help to get your message out as far and wide as we can across America.
Thanks very much.
Good night. God bless you, sir. Okay, this is Dr. Stan. And of course, this is the time when we have to bid adieu to our listeners up in the Great Northwest, there in Washington and Northern Oregon and Western Idaho. We ask you to please tell others about these programs. We ask you to please remember we do a program up there on the American Christian Network every Saturday at noontime. And, of course, we'll be on the program that's 810 out of Spokane, the big station there. But tell others we need them to listen this weekend. We're going to have Joel Skousen, and we're going to be talking about the coming war and the implications of that war and how it's going to affect every person listening to this program. So, well, until tomorrow evening, we ask you to pray for America and pray for our leaders, pray for our ministers, because, believe me, society reflects the church, and look at society today. And then please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But right now, we ask you to hold your calls. We are going to have with us Dr. Len Horowitz, supposedly. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the articles that have come out the last couple of days, talking about the government plan to vaccinate every American citizen within 5 days if there's even one case of smallpox here in the United States. Now, this would be, as far as I can tell, forced vaccination. You have to understand that CDC appointed a panel of experts to determine what should be done in case of a smallpox outbreak. And their consensus was, well, first of all, maybe we ought to immunize no more than maybe 50,000 first responders. And then if there is a case of smallpox, we'll do ring vaccination, but of course don't vaccinate the entire population, because a certain number of people are going to die and get encephalitis and permanent damage, and you'd only really vaccinate about three-quarters of the people anyway, because you don't want to vaccinate the people with an altered immune system, a chronic illness, or immunodeficiency of some sort. You're just going to do nothing but harm. That was the official government panel. Well, of course, you have to understand that the official government panels are simply appointed, and if they come up with a conclusion you've already decided on, you agree with them and you say, yes, good job. Otherwise, you say good job, and then you do what you want to, because the decision had already been made. vaccinate everybody in America. In fact, Tommy Thompson, the Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, said, we're going to have a bottle of vaccine for every American with their name on it. And doesn't that make you feel good, especially when you know that, for instance, in the Philippines and Kenya, why they use vaccination to sterilize the women. They put a contraceptive product in there. And I've talked to doctors from both areas, and at least a doctor from Kenya, and the gentleman who was in charge of their population control unit over in the Philippines. And I guess that's exactly what they did. The World Health Organization came in and vaccinated women. We've got free vaccine shots for you. We're here to help. We're from the World Health Organization. And it's not even going to cost you anything. Just roll up your sleeve, ladies. And, of course, it was aimed at aborting them. They had put, they gave them tetanus toxoid. You know, that was the hook. But the reality was they wanted, of course, to create a situation where they wouldn't be able to have children. And then, of course, we know that in San Francisco, where the homosexuals, these young men, who, and I will give them credit for wanting to help stop the spread of hepatitis, but they really weren't very smart. 80% of those who took the vaccinations in the San Francisco area came down with AIDS, and probably almost all of them are dead now, whereas AIDS in the general population was far less than half of that HIV infection. So they have basically something in that vaccine, but nobody ever wants to ask the question. We know over 200,000 Gulf War veterans now who trusted their government and went off to fight for freedom in the Gulf. Have come back, and of course over 200,000 have reported that they have the symptoms of Gulf War illness. They're registered with the Veterans Administration. We don't know how many have died. We hear all the stories, but of course the government is keeping that information classified. I suppose they don't want the Russians to find out. With us this evening is Dr. Len Horowitz. Hi, Len. How are you doing?
Hi, good. Very, very good, Sam. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, you know, one of the things that really disturbs me is this plan that they've come up with now, that instead of ring vaccinating people, which, of course, has a certain public health, you know, history, they want to give every American citizen a smallpox vaccine within 5 days if there's even one case in the United States. What's wrong with this scenario?
Well, it's absolutely ridiculous. It's standard Machiavellian fare, whereby they've created this fright, and that's really largely what it is. I sincerely doubt that we will have a smallpox outbreak, and that if we do, who's implicated is the United States and or Russia, since they're the only people that have this in their biological weapons arsenals at this point.
And, of course, we know that the anthrax a vaccine that killed people here, you know, last year, had come from American military labs, and, gee, we just can't figure out who stole it. Was that simply an experiment to see what would happen?
Well, I think it's always an experiment, and so is this vaccine. In fact, this is exactly what you're even being told in mainstream media. New York Times covered it very well today. William Broad had an article. And in it, you could see that they're required to take, and actually what I should mention right up front is that it is not going to be a mandated vaccination. It is a voluntary vaccine. The Bush administration's plan states that it's voluntary. They say that they will incarcerate you and quarantine you if you do not volunteer, however. And that, of course, does not bode well for the United States Constitution and freedom of rights and religious freedoms.
Well, that sounds like sort of that mandatory volunteerism that George Bush keeps talking about. He wants us to volunteer for public service, and if we don't, why, we'll be punished.
Yeah, right. Well, that's exactly it. And so it's doublespeak. But the bottom line is that it's clearly experimental, and they're going to have you, before you get the shot, they're going to have you sign an informed consent waiver freeing the government and the pharmaceutical industrialists, vaccine producers, from liability because it is recognized as an experiment.
So well, then why, of course, are they going to do this if it's only an experiment?
Because, you know, again, you and I both know that this is to do two things. One is it is to enhance the fright, and through the fright, they can enhance the legislative activities to ultimately coerce, enslave, and kill populations at will. Through all the legislation and all the direction, allegedly in the name of public health and national security. So that's number one. It is a fright and they are playing it up to the max in every aspect of what's going on today. Ultimately, it's basically behavioral engineering on a massive scale.
And really, it's really very interesting how they're using the mass media to create the fear of smallpox, and yet that for years they've been telling us, look, you don't need smallpox vaccine. We've got it all under control. There's none in the world, and we're going to do away with the last little bit of virus we have and the right. last bit of vaccine. We don't need it anymore. Whoops, well, now maybe Saddam Hussein has it, and, oh, we've got to do something. We've got to vaccinate everybody. And yet, of course, if you understand that there is a genocidal policy out there.
That's right. That's the second issue. The fact is they want to kill half of the world's population, and in the remaining half that still survives, they want to inject a virtual mark of the beast. Perhaps a medical biochip, the mandatory smallpox vaccine would be a fantastic venue to deliver that. And that, I believe, really in my heart, based on all the scientific evidence, based on all the government documents we've been able to find, this is what we're looking at, nothing else. It is a major royal scam and a gross breach of human rights.
And I think that anybody who doubts that there is an organized plan to kill off a large part of the population really needs to read Len Horowitz's book, Emerging Viruses, and you can go up on my webpage and read my little short population control agenda monograph, but get Len's book, Emerging Viruses. I think it's one of the finest books. It certainly had a profound impact on my thought process, and it, of course, only tended to verify what I already knew, and that is there are evil and wicked people out there who intend to kill off the vast majority of the world's population. Len says half the world's population. I think it probably will be 9/10 of the world's population. And why do I believe that? Well, of course, Jacques Cousteau talks about the necessity of killing 350,000 people a day. And you know, if Jerry Falwell had said that, why, of course, it would be on the front pages of every paper, and nobody would ever let him forget it. But when Jacques Cousteau said that in the UNESCO Courier in November of 1991, he got a get-out-of-hell-free card. I mean, nobody ever mentioned that. It's never been quoted any place. We have it. We actually checked it out. We'll be glad to send you a copy of the UNESCO Courier in either French or English where he made that statement. And when he died last, I guess was either this year or last year, why, he's still lauded by the media. Here's a man who dwarfs, Adolf Hitler in 20 days, why he would have killed more people than Hitler killed in all of the Holocaust in Germany, at least as far as the Jews were concerned. He talks about the necessity of eliminating 350,000 people a day. In 20 days, you'd kill well over 6 million people, closer to 7 million. But why do we ever talk about that? Or maybe it's they don't want the people to know until after they've been vaccinated.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm looking at, the same analysis, Dan. And it does not bode well, particularly for people who have no ears to hear this type of information and no eyes to see the documentation that we provide through the various publications.
Well, one of the big scams now is this West Nile virus. Day after day, week after week, month after month, every day there's something on the West Nile virus, and they found a new bird or a new crow, or 60 people have died or something.
Right now it stands at 98.
Is that all told over the last several years?
All told.
Right.
Date.
And, of course, why don't you explain to our people why, we do not have to be terrified by the West Nile virus? And what's this latest article? It just appeared today. Oh, the West Nile virus is giving you polio. What? I mean, are the people that stupid? Why don't you pick that story up?
I missed that one.
Oh, you did?
Background on that one.
Well, this is apparently there's a doctor who's taken care of a number of patients with West Nile virus, and now it's giving them polio. The people present with the same picture. They have respiratory paralysis. They'll have isolated weakness of their limbs. And apparently it's a lower motor neuron or anterior horn type of a disease, so that they have a flaccid paralysis. And of course the caption on the article I read today was that the West Nile virus is creating polio. If you want me to, I can send you the article. I got this off the internet, and then I read it in the local newspaper today. And West Nile virus is not going to give you polio. It may give you some weakness and paralysis, but ordinarily I've never even heard of that before. Have you?
No. This is, I think, part and parcel of the way the mainstream media is mixing everything up. And it is kind of like shake, rattle, and roll people's minds. It's the Hegelian dialectic where thesis and antithesis are being presented. Ultimately, you get mass confusion and a manipulated and capable of being manipulated population.
Absolutely. In fact, you give people too much information, and they get so confused they can't figure out which way is up. And this is what they did with the Pavlovian dogs, what the Russians did with the Pavlovian dogs, and this is what they're doing with the minds of the American people. And unless you understand that you're being manipulated, why all you do is sit around wringing your hands and, oh, it's terrible, and we're all going to die, and, gee, we better rush out and get vaccinated, if there is or is not a case of smallpox, even though the government's own panel said this is a ridiculous response.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's what I think is most notable in the scam. And so half a mnemonic indicative of this being a royal ruse. the fact is, you said it. It was only in June that the top smallpox executive for emergency management of the federal government at CDC said there's nothing to worry about, folks. We're not going to recommend vaccinations for anyone. It is not a highly transmissible disease. It is not a disease that bioterrorists can use very readily and with barrier protections and infection control and methods today and modern medicine. We really don't have to worry. Suddenly, here it is just a few months later, and the whole thing is completely changed. And what do you make of that? I can only make that this is a complete scam.
Well, of course it is. I mean, why bother to have a blue ribbon committee if you're not going to listen to what they say and you're going to let Tommy Thompson and George Bush decide what's good for us medically? I mean, these people have no idea of epidemiology or public health, but these are political decisions, and political decisions always have another motivation. And what's so frightening is we're giving an unproven vaccine to large numbers, to the entire population. What happens if it does to the American people what the vaccinations given to our veterans during the Gulf War did, where we have almost a third of them, and maybe it's everybody who got the anthrax vaccine. We don't know, because somebody conveniently lost the shot records over there,
right.
Unless, of course, somebody...
Wasn't it blown up in Oklahoma? Building when it exploded? That's what I heard.
I don't know, but I mean, the whole story is just so... Anybody wants to verify what I'm saying, it's all covered either in my newsletters in a book called Germs by Judith Miller, where she tells how they just misplaced all of those shot records. If anybody believes that happened, why they probably are waiting for their Tyco stock to come back again.
Judith Miller is one of the propagandists who lead today's articles on smallpox in the New York Times.
No question she is, but her book is really, it got a lot of good information, because you can't write a book without putting out some truth, and there is some truth in it.
That's exactly what we do. We have to search the 80% of the truth, the little nuggets that they have in there, allow us to do the work that we do.
Well, anyway, of course, if you're out there in the listening audience and you're concerned, and I am deeply concerned about this effort to frighten us into, of course, accepting vaccination, and specifically the smallpox vaccination, and I think that people will be very, very, very foolish to be vaccinated when you know the history of vaccinations, and if you don't, when you need to go to my website and look at my June and July newsletters, and that's only a brief history of vaccinations. We want to get some really good information. While you go to Len Horwitz's website, how can people get on your website, get your information, Len?
Real easy. I'll give you two websites, and one is the publisher's website, tetrahedron.org. That's a geometric figure that is spelled T as in Thomas, E as in Edward, T as in Thomas, R-A-H, Robert Andrew Henry, E-D, Edward David, Ron. Tetrahedron.org as an organization. You go to tetrahedron.com, that takes you to the enemy's camp. It's a chemical company.
Okay, fine.
And then the other one is the American Red Double Cross .com, all small letters. American Red Double Cross .com. It's a whole spoof on the American Red Cross, the blood banksters, and their efforts to work with the Central Intelligence Agency to conduct genocide.
Oh, that sounds like an interesting concept. You want to develop that at all?
Oh, certainly. You know, again, when you think back of the Lawrence Rockefeller and the Rockefeller brothers. It was Lawrence that put together the New York City Blood Council. That was the council of doctors that put together the New York City Blood Bank. They became the International Blood Banksters. These were the people that allowed for 10,000 hemophiliacs throughout the United States and countless others around the world to get the HIV-contaminated blood that they knew was contaminated between 1980 and 86 and did nothing significant to clean it up. And when you look at the history of the Rockefeller family, as we've laid it out in the book Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola, whereby they were full-fledged, quote, married, end quote, according to the United States Congressional records and federal investigations, and a federal court judge having committed, having proclaimed the Rockefellers were committing treason against the United States during World War II by not only operating with the enemy, but withholding from our allies, England, particularly the petroleum products that they were giving to Hitler. And in fact, it was Rockefeller's IG Farben cartel, that German petrochemical pharmaceutical cartel, of which Bayer, today's makers of Cipro for anthrax, they were the leaders of the pack of the three ultimately major corporations that were spun off of IG Farben at the end of World War II. They were Hoechst, BASF, and Bayer. And Merck received the remaining funds, and we've just, in those four companies, identified all the major players in smallpox vaccines, as well as anthrax vaccines, as well as anthrax antibiotics. So that should give you some background. Now, Rockefellers have played a central role in this disgusting ruse for all these decades. The bottom line is that the Standard Oil Company, run by Rockefellers, there were more stocks issued to Herman Schmitz of the Bayer Aspirin Corporation than any individual Rockefeller held. Herman Schmitz was the man who ran the Nazi concentration camp labor facilities. It was the Rockefellers that held the patent on the synthetic oil and rubber that the Holocaust victims were about to produce in the Holocaust victim built and run factories outside of Auschwitz, that Herman Schmitz, partner of Rockefellers, was running. So this should give you some idea of the information that's on the AmericanRedDoubleCross.com website, along with the fact that how it was at the end of World War II that all the Nazi gold and all the Nazi money was transported out of Germany. It was primarily through the rat lines and the secret identifications, the false identifications were issued by the Dulles brothers and the Rockefeller clan, given under American Red Cross credentials for Nazi war criminals to escape. Many of them, of course, made it, as you know, stand under Project Paperclip to America, to become America's most esteemed and advanced researchers in the fields of virology, such as Eric Traub, Hitler's top biological weapons developer, went to work for the United States Navy. And then you had others that also went into military and industrial networks.
And, of course, many of them then were allowed to escape to South America, where they lived out comfortably on their ill-gotten gains. And most Americans don't know that Heinrich Mueller, the head of the Gestapo, was brought here, you know, given a nice, soft, good-paying job, and he lived out here the rest of his life. So we rewarded the Nazis very well. And, of course, people said that couldn't be true. The Nazis were the bad guys. They were the enemy. But, of course, they may have been your enemy and my enemy, but they were not the enemy of the Rockefellers and the Dulles brothers and this clique of very evil and wicked people who are really behind so much of what's going on today. And what people don't understand is the Rockefellers have always kept in the background, but they have been the driving force behind this whole movement to change the world, to bring about the New World Order and the New World Religion. And, of course, major backers of the Lucius Trust and major backers of the United Nations and major backers of so much of what's going on in the world today. So, I think it's important that you go to Lens, get Lens material, because I've looked at it in the past and it's all well documented. And, there's so much information there that you're never going to get any place else. In fact, that one tape that you have of Dr. Hillerman working at the NIH, I think he probably by this time he was with Merck, And he actually made the statement at a meeting that we brought AIDS to America when we brought the monkeys to America. Isn't that right?
Yes, he said basically that, to paraphrase it, that he brought in to North America contaminated monkeys destined for vaccine research and development, the AIDS virus. And in fact, his colleague Benjamin Sweet, who was the second in command of Merck's pharmaceutical vaccine department, he also admitted the same thing. He says, with regard to the new evidence that is coming forward showing the links between vaccines and AIDS, he says, it, quote, just blows my mind, end quote. So this is what we're dealing with. Stan, you know, I've got some good news for you.
All right. Well, boy, I should like some good news about that.
About this particular subject. And then I've got an even more fun piece of new information to share with you. This just really happened over the last couple days. You may be aware that the United States General Accounting Office totally whitewashed and committed scientific fraud the special virus cancer program information and their investigation into the principal premise that I advanced in the book Emerging Viruses. That happened in June. Well, here's the good news. Amnesty International has just taken up the gauntlet. There is going to be an official investigation by Amnesty International into all of the work I've laid out in the book Emerging Viruses, AIDS, and Ebola. It's going to be voted on, and I believe very favorably, in November at a Washington, D.C. meeting where I've been asked to attend. They're having me come in to be not only a speaker but on a panel. And their officials have drafted a resolution. And if I can pull that up on my computer, you might be interested to hear about it, because it really relays this entire story that you're referring to with regard to Dr. Hilleman and his links to the biological weapons developers at Litton Bionetics, who are responsible for overseeing the United States Army's biological weapons arsenals, as well as the National Cancer Institute's effort in the Special Virus Cancer Program. So if you'd like, I can either send that to you or I can relay it to you on the air.
Well, why don't you do both? I'd love to hear it, and I think our listeners would as well. And basically, for our listeners out there, Dr. Of course, Horowitz contends that the virus was disseminated, here in the United States in the hepatitis B vaccine given to homosexual men. And do you think it was disseminated in Africa with the hepatitis vaccine that was given there, or how do you think it was disseminated in Africa?
Well, I really respect your knowledge, and I'm not going to pull any fast ones on you because I know that you're smart enough to know. So I'm going to just lay it out really straight and clear for you and your listeners what it is that I have found. Number one is I can't, as a scientist, nor can you, based on all the evidence that we have, even though we have things like Dr. Hilleman's virtual smoking gun testimony saying that he did it. What we have to conclude based on all the evidence that we have is that it is not an act of nature that AIDS suddenly broke out on two far-removed continents in two totally demographically distinct populations, that is, gay men in New York City and black women in Central Africa. That occurred primarily because of a hepatitis B vaccine. Now, here is the science that I know you'll appreciate, and I hope I'll make it clear enough for your listeners to understand. And this is the difficulty with claiming that it was an act of intent, although all the massive amount of evidence that you and I have gathered would clearly argue that. It is also potentially an accident of the despicable contaminations that they had allowed to occur in the vaccine production industry, and particularly in these labs that were affiliated also with America's chief biological weapons developers that were, in fact, working on developing such a virus at that time for massive population control, particularly in Africa. Now, that's the subject of great interest to Amnesty International, that tries to go worldwide and determine where are the human rights violations being perpetrated against populations. So here's what happened. You and I both know that the chimpanzee virus is a simian immunodeficiency virus from the chimp is the closest thing going to the human AIDS virus. So therefore, we have to understand, how is it possible that a chimpanzee sequence ended up in the human AIDS virus 1? And the best explanation for that is that in the 50s and early 60s with the polio vaccines, that we were injected en masse with monkey viruses from SV40 to simian foamy retroviruses that had the unique enzyme that makes the AIDS virus tick. And those things readily recombine in people's bloodstreams and in their bodies. And so at that point in the 1950s and 60s with both the Salk and Sabin contaminated polio vaccines given to the gay men who 10 years later would receive subsequently another vaccine called the hepatitis B vaccine that had been produced, get this, in, again, contaminated chimpanzees and rhesus monkeys. So what they did was they grew the hepatitis B viruses in the chimpanzees that Litton Bionetics shipped from Africa to New York.
Now, did they grow it in the kidneys, or did they grow it in just the whole animal? Where did they grow it?
I believe they grew it in the whole animals in these early studies.
Okay.
And the reason why I say that is because when you research the original scientific papers that I was, by the grace of God, able to unearth, the chief hepatitis experts for NIAID, National Institute for Allergies and Infectious Diseases, stated that he had trouble growing it in live human beings. He could not grow enough, he said, in the Willowbrook State School mentally retarded children that they had been injecting with these cancer viruses for a decade before around 1973-74.
Now, for our listeners, these are mentally defective children in the Willow Creek institution. They were just using them as human guinea pigs. They were not real people. They were just they were using them for growing viruses.
That's right. And this was under the United States Army's contract by Dr. Saul Krugman at the New York University Medical Center, which was also a documented biological weapons contractor. So now, having that clarity, here we are, we've got two populations, blacks in Africa, gay men in New York, who have been virtual incubation chambers for a decade with monkey cancer viruses recombining in their own bodies. Then now, they take chimpanzees and rhesus monkeys from Africa, they inject the animals to grow more virus, they inject the animals to grow the hepatitis B viruses. When they had grown enough, they extracted the live viruses out of those live animals, and of course all the other viral contaminants come with it when you do that. Now they inject the gay men again and the blacks in Central Africa with these complete mixture of new monkey and chimpanzee cancer viruses.
We're going to be back here in just a minute and hold that thought, Len, and when we get back, of course, let Tim tell the rest of the story, and then we'll take some calls. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when, of course, we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we're dependent on those of you who listen to us here on the Central Coast of California or out across America to help us, to lend us a hand so we can continue getting the information out, the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And so if you believe that there's a problem, if you'd like to become part of our team, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and join our effort to educate the American people, because without your help, we can't do what we're doing. But we're gradually increasing the number of stations that are carrying at least some of our programming, and then all we can do is put the word out, and then if God motivates people or brings them to listen to the program, perhaps what we have said will touch their lives. At least that's our plan, and of course we depend upon you, first of all, to tell others about our programs, to tell them about our website, which is RadioLiberty.com, and then we hope that many of you will decide you're going to partner with us in what we're doing, and that's as simple as joining, giving us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like a catalog, if you'd like a copy of our newsletter, our latest newsletter deals with what really happened with the Oklahoma City bombing. And, of course, the truth of the matter was that there were Islamic radicals tied to Osama bin Laden there, but we couldn't let the American people know because it wasn't the time. The script says nothing was going to happen until the year 2001 or 2002, and so we couldn't let the American people know at that time. And after all, if they'd known at that time, why, they would have had to start investigating the Islamic radicals, and they wouldn't have been so free to open here. Or they wouldn't have operated freely and been quite as brave if they'd known that they might be intercepted by our FBI. So the FBI wasn't allowed to investigate them. they were, if the Islamic radicals were given in the sense of the get out of jail free card, or a free card to just go ahead and hijack our planes and crash them into any building they wanted to, and the government knew what the plan was. And if you don't believe that, we've got the recent report came out of the Joint Committee of Intelligence for the Senate and for the House, and we offer that to our ministry, and it's an amazing, amazing report. All the evidence that points to the fact that they knew the attack was coming here, and they knew it was going to involve airplanes, and they knew it was going to involve the World Trade Center. And that's the government report, and that's already been redacted and cleaned up. You can imagine what was in it before the CIA laundered it. And so if you want to get the information to help us bring the attention of the American people to what's going on, if you want to help us inform the American people about the true spiritual battle behind all of these things we talk about, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That newsletter is the August newsletter. If you want the newsletter on vaccines, I will send you one of them if you haven't had them before. We'll send the July one, which goes into the background of vaccines, and of course why you should be very, very concerned about the effort for mandatory vaccination. Oh, it's all voluntary, but of course we'll put you in jail and fine you if you don't get vaccinated because you're a menace to the public health. Ladies and gentlemen, if you understand, you have to be responsible for your health. And if it means you have to say no, you're going to have to learn to say it. It's a one-letter word that needs to be repeated over again. No, no, no. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Len Horowitz. And hold your calls until we ask for them, as I want to hear this story myself. And remember our number? It's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is at war today. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Len Horowitz, my ministry is his books, Death in the Air, and of course, Emerging Viruses, are both available through our ministry. If you'd like to know anything more about them or suggest a donation, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Well, Len, you were telling us about how now they, and most people don't understand that with the two polio vaccines, first the Salk and then the Sabin, they contaminated the entire population with these monkey viruses. First the SV40, which is a cancer-producing virus. The second with these foamy viruses, these cytomegalic monkey viruses. So almost the entire population has been contaminated by vaccines. And, of course, they don't dare let the American people know because they'd lose confidence in the government. So pick up the story from there, Len.
Right. So then once they had grown enough of the hepatitis B viruses in these contaminated animals, and, again, they were shipped contaminated. That's what Dr. Hilleman was complaining about at Merck in 1970-71 when they were producing this vaccine. And he threatened to quit because they were so contaminated. But he didn't. He continued with it. And that they then extracted the live hepatitis B viruses out of the live animals. And again, the problem with that is when you extract a live virus out of a live animal, all of the other viral contaminants come with it. Now, here's what they did with that then viral mixture. They injected it once again into the gay men in New York City, the Willowbrook State School mentally retarded children on Staten Island in New York, and then to the African population as well. There is also some evidence that there may have been two other populations in the United States injected, the American natives, Native Americans, Indians, as well as the kidney dialysis patients. Both of those populations were also considered at higher risk for hepatitis B infection, and that was the rationale that they used to say it was justified, this particular study was justified. Again, it was a genocidal experiment. So the fact is, once they injected these gay men, many of them died, and the children died, and the blacks died. But the ones that survived, and there were some, by the grace of God, you know that the immune system works wonders in many cases. And so those were the individuals whose blood they then stole to make the final vaccine. They took their blood, they separated the whole cells from the serum, and it was then from the serum that they used. In fact, here's one more last, finally, totally disgusting and confounding factor in this whole sick mess. It is the fact that they pooled, Stan, they pooled the serum. Of all the different gay men, they pooled all that serum. So if one or two gay men, that means out of a group of, let's say, 200, had the AIDS virus, then they pooled the blood, and in the pooling of blood, then they then subsequently used the pooled blood to make the vaccine, and that's then what they delivered to literally hundreds more gay men.
Now, is that what they used in San Francisco, or what?
Yes, now ultimately then they expanded the experiments in 1978, but I'm talking about the earliest experiments that came in 1974 and 1975. And you know what's fascinating? You know how wonderful people out there who listen to us are. They give us, you know, they're our eyes and their ears, and they send us things. Isn't that right?
Yes, they sure do.
And I had someone send me a Merck Pharmaceutical Company funded documentary that showed the recruiting of the earliest gay men into the hepatitis B vaccine program way back in the early 70s. It's priceless because it's virtually a nail in a coffin that we're going to hopefully very soon by the grace of God create for these devil doers with the help of Amnesty International.
Well, you know, it's so interesting. If you really study the study that was in San Francisco, and that was one of my first introductions to the whole thing, and you're looking at pretty close to 80% of the young men who volunteered for this experiment, you know, and they thought that, you know, they're going to come up with a hepatitis B vaccine that's going to, help prevent the spread of this disease. Almost 80% of them came down with HIV disease and developed AIDS and died. Now, how can you justify something like that? And even more, how you can conceal that from the American people. But the idea that there would have been something in that vaccine that would have promoted the AIDS is so foreign to the average individual. We can't imagine anything could be that evil. And so we ignore the obvious. And I'll have to admit, I ignored that for years until I read your book. And then I began remembering, at the most, 30 to 40% of the general homosexual population has AIDS. But here, this group, 80% of those who took the vaccine. And that should have been a red flag for everybody at the time, but it's been totally ignored.
Yeah. That's exactly right. You know, it's just, it's unbelievable. You know, the older I get, the more it's just like I think I'm living in a nightmare that I'd love to wake up from some morning.
Well, Chris, we don't know whether it was intentional or whether it was an accident, is what you're basically saying.
Well, I tell you from my heart, it was intentional. All the evidence, the circumstantial evidence screams that. But, you know, you and I were medical people, were scientifically trained. We have a training background that says we can't jump to conclusions. We have to be very conservative. We don't want to make a mistake. And we have to have really solid, solid, solid science before we can come out with something. I can only say that the solid science we have shows very clearly that this was not an act of God. It was not a natural cross-species transmission. It was either an accident, which I doubt, or it was intentional. And the massive scientific evidence screams accidental, and the mass of scientific and circumstantial evidence screams intentional.
But of course, you know, if we take the next step, and that is, why has the epidemic continued to spread? And of course, it continues to spread because we are preaching promiscuity now in Uganda, where they have said that, you know, people should be abstinent. The disease has been pretty well brought under control, and the incidence of disease has dropped dramatically in Uganda. But that's not because they're pushing the sex education and the immoral education, the programs we're preaching here, and the rest of Africa. That's because the leader of the Ugandan nation and his wife are saying, you know, abstinence before marriage and fidelity after marriage is the only solution. And yet, in every other country, while they're passing out condoms and tell people to go ahead and be promiscuous, just use a condom, and you go into Botswana, and there, and this is a very highly advanced African nation, very high educational standards, a small one-tribe country, really very, very prosperous until recently. There, of course, of women 20 to 35, 50% are HIV positive, and they're all going to die. Now, And, of course, you could do that bad a job unintentionally, because are they changing it? Are they going to say, maybe we're doing something wrong? They say, oh, no, we're going to stop this disease with education. Are you going to stop it when 75% are infected, when 85% are infected, when 90% are infected? At what point do you say, why, we have a failed public health policy? Or maybe the public health policy has failed. Maybe it's really very, very successful. Only, of course, its objective is not to save lives, but to destroy them.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's just amazing. I marvel at the fact that the general public doesn't wake up to the scam. You know, I'm reminded with what your last statement is of Jonathan Mann, who was the AIDS czar for the World Health Organization before he perished in flight, I guess, what was
it? TW-800.
Yeah, that flight that had all the AIDS experts on it. And I knew him vaguely. He was sitting next to Robert Gallo at the meeting where I confronted Gallo with the facts and embarrassed Gallo. And Jonathan Mann saw the whole thing. And his wife was a major hepatitis B vaccine researcher at Johns Hopkins. And so the two of them really knew what was really going on. And I believe they killed him. I believe they took that flight out intentionally. Among the reasons was to kill Jonathan Mann. Here's why. He left the World Health Organization. He quit it as the highest man in charge of AIDS for the UN and the World Health Organization. He left and said this. He said, far more than a medical and public health issue, AIDS is a social political imposition.
Well, I had met Jonathan Mann on one or two occasions at meetings, and I rather liked him. I thought he was an honest man, and there are a lot of honest people out there. But, of course, what you and I are talking about is so improbable to their frame of reference. They cannot imagine the degree of evil that we're up against. And, you know, if it ever does hit them, why, it would just totally shatter their belief in everything, because most doctors, most scientists really do want to save human lives.
That's
but
right.
There's just a very, very small group of evil ones, and they're the ones who get the grants, and they're the ones who become the professors, and they're the ones who are promoted to key positions, and they're the ones, of course, who are promoting a genocidal world public health policy.
Yeah. Did I ever tell you the story of the movie Green Mile?
No, go ahead.
Because it has such relevance to what you just said with regard to the attitudes of these doctors and the blindness. The Green Mile is a marvelous movie. There's one line that makes the entire movie worthwhile. It's a story about a black man who's an angel. He comes down. He's a huge guy. He stands about 7 foot tall. And he doesn't speak too well, but he loves laying hands on people and literally raising the dead, like Lazarus. So he comes down, and he happens upon two little girls who were raped and killed by a serial killer, and he's in the process of trying to restore their lives. When the police come, they apprehend him, they immediately blame him for the murder, and they incarcerate him. He spends a couple years in jail, during which time he heals Tom Hanks, who plays the warden in marvelous acting, and several other of the officers. He heals Hanks's prostate cancer, and at the end of the movie, Hanks comes to him and he says, listen, I know you did not do this. He says, I'm going to give you the keys to get out of here. Run, because you're on death row. You're going to face the electric chair next week unless you get out of here. This guy says, no, I'm going to stay. I want to die. And Hank says, why waste such a glorious spirit? Why don't you go on and heal others? He says, no, I want to leave this planet. He says, here's the line. I can't stand the way they use love to kill. You know, if you love your children, you get them vaccinated. If you love your country, you send your children to war. If you love public health, you get committed to what the mainstream media propaganda line is, and you follow it. This is how we as a human race have become so susceptible to manipulation, coercion, enslavement, and even premature death, murder, is because we love.
Well, of course, it's misguided love. It's the inability of people to face and see the truth. And I can't be too critical of people because I really opposed your view that this, you know, was a man-made virus for a long time until I read your book. And, of course, I'd already been in contact with Strecker's work. But I just could not bring myself to accept the obvious. And I remember when I to give talks all over the country, and you know, people would put their hand up, and usually be a black man or a black woman in the back of the room. They'd say, "Well, we've heard this virus was created to kill off the blacks. Is it true?" And I'd say, "Well, you're just asking the wrong question. You know, you should be asking why aren't we trying to use the standard public health techniques to control the infection? You know, that's the question you should be asking." And I really wasn't smart enough. It took me, I don't know how many years, before I finally realized that the answer to both questions was exactly the same. You know, yeah. This is a created virus, and we intentionally are not trying to stop its spread.
Yeah.
And, of course, when you put the two of them together, you come up with a horrible realization that we are facing organized evil. And at that point, then, of course, we can be effective in this battle. And, of course, I know that this battle has had a profound impact on your life personally, and you've come to change your views on what important spiritually.
Oh, absolutely. And I fell into the same trap, Stan. For years, as a public health dentist, was going around promoting water fluoridation. You know, it was just I was sick, and I then spent 3 years going around promoting hepatitis B vaccinations for healthcare professionals while I was working for Henry Schein Corporation. And so, I mean, I feel like horrible. I've likely in those days, I'm still repenting for my sins. You know, I caused people to suffer, if not die. And so let me tell you the good news that I failed to tell you. There was one other thing that I wanted to share with you, and I've got to get this to you. You have access to the internet, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Well, tomorrow on the www.tetrahedron.org website, I believe it will be finished. There will be a download of an extraordinarily incredible song that you have to download and play for your listeners and all the radio shows that you do.
All right, what is it about?
Well, you remember Country Joe McDonald did a song about the Vietnam War during Woodstock?
No, I really don't, but...
Okay, well, there's a group that was called the 1969 Country Joe McDonald and the Fish, Country Joe and the Fish. And his song became virtually the rallying cry for the baby boomers and the hippie generations that ultimately helped definitively to stop end the Vietnam War. Well, over the last several weeks, I've been in touch with Country Joe, and I've rewritten the lyrics to his song. We went this weekend into a studio, and we produced the Iraqi War song. And I just released it today. We just released it.
I just played it
on the air today.
Who does the singing?
Yours truly.
All right.
I do the leads.
All right, fine. Well, we'll have to get that and play it because, you know, I'll have to admit, I look back at the time of the Vietnam War, and I really supported the war. I mean, I felt that the people who were against the war, you know, were pro-communist, and I'll have to admit I wasn't very, very smart at the time. Now, a lot of them opposed the war for the wrong reason, but they were right in opposing it, absolutely right. And only looking back now can I realize how wrong I was. But, you know, it takes a long time before people can begin to see things as they really are. And, you know, I have the wisdom of remembering Korea and remembering Vietnam. And, of course, I'm patriotic, and I want, you know, I want to defeat communism, and I want to stand by my country. And yet, of course, our country was financing the North Vietnamese all during that war. And the wicked people who were doing that, of course, were also directing the war. So they were playing both sides, and they were playing the hippies against the patriots or the conservatives, the right against the left. And they're doing it right now. And we find that really the only organized effort out there against this war are the anarchists and the communists and the socialists and the kids going to college. And they're absolutely right. And we find the Christian ministers, many of our Christian leaders, we got to get in there. We got to take out that wicked Saddam Hussein. We've got to get the American people to think and to realize what we are doing. And as one of the Arab leaders recently said, America is going to open the gates of hell. And I really believe that's true.
Yes, and I do believe that this is a holy war as well. This is a spiritual warfare that's taking place.
And you know what you're saying is exactly correct. The news all evening long was the Democrats versus the Republicans. The Republicans are the warmongers. The Democrats are saying, well, we shouldn't go in. Certainly we shouldn't go in alone, and we should wait. And so this issue right now is at the forefront in American politics. And so we just released the Iraqi war song. It's subtitled, "Feel Like I'm Smelling a Rat Rag." And the name of the band is Country Bumpkin and the Hogs instead of Country Joe and the Fish.
All right, fine. So you have the permission, then you put the song together, and do you hope to get it on the hit parade?
Well, we're going to work on it, and that's why I ask for you, your support, and anyone who's listening out there. Tomorrow you should be able to get on to the tetrahedron.org website and download it. We are asking for a small donation. The funds, the profits, are going to fund the Amnesty International AIDS investigations, their work, as well as a very important new fund that we're just forming. It's a fund to help American political prisoners. And more of us, Dan, I think we really need to come to terms with this. More of us and our colleagues over the coming years and maybe even months are going to be at grave risk of being taken out or at least incarcerated. It just has happened this week to one of my colleagues, and she was on my show just a couple weeks ago. She was an insider in the Human Genome Project, and she was a whistleblower. And they suddenly came. She's an attorney and PhD in genetics. They came, they arrested her. Today she sits in jail, and there's no bond, there's no nothing.
Well,
she can't get out.
What was her crime?
The crime was telling the truth. The crime was fingering the man who currently leads the anthrax investigation in Washington, D.C.
And that was the FBI, fellow with the FBI.
That's right. The director of the FBI for Washington region right now was the director of the FBI in the Ohio region, and with regard to Battelle Memorial Institute, she is a whistleblower in that whole realm, and she got on my program, she laid it all out, and just a couple days ago they came together. And now, do you remember, I think you do, a couple years ago the psychological literature, the scam literature, the pseudoscientific literature was saying that people who, like you and I, who think the way we think about the government conspiracies, that we are mentally ill?
No, of course. Well, that's the thing. If you don't go along with the everybody else thinks, you must be mentally ill. We've got Theodora on the line. I just want to get her before the end of the
program. Yeah, let me just
program.
Tell you, that's how they are holding her. They're saying she is mentally ill based on her voicing the conspiracy concerns.
Okay, fine. Well, Theodora, do you have a question or comment?
Well, if listening to folks like you and Len Horowitz means I'm mentally ill, I'm proud to be mentally ill. And I just really want to thank you, Dr. Horowitz, for the work you've done. I followed you for many years. I give your website out. And I just, you know, you're one of the brave people on the front lines, really, showing us what the lie is. And I want to bless your journey. And I'm really encouraged to hear about the Amnesty International taking up your cause. So I'm
want
to put
so
a call
much.
Out to everyone out there hearing. Put a prayer in for that. This is major.
Amen to that.
Amen.
And thank you again, Dr. Stan.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye, Theodora. Okay, Theodora is one of our regular listeners there, and really a champion of the cause of righteousness and personal freedom. And, of course, this is the problem we're facing, is that freedom is under attack today. And, of course, if you speak the truth, why, you can get in real trouble. Actually, I was asked to write a letter by a doctor in Oregon who's been there threatening to take away his medical license because he said that he thinks that there's a move towards world government. And actually, he's going to be going to trial to defend his medical license, and his crime was why he said he thinks there's a move to create a world government. Well, I say I think anybody is mentally ill who doesn't think there's a move to be a world government. Len, we're just about out of time. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, again, get this, put a smile on your face. There's other ways than what we have been doing. We're just trying one more way to get the same message out. Get on the website tomorrow. Get the Iraqi War song. You will really greatly appreciate it. It is a fantastic production, and it relays everything from the vaccination issues to the Rockefeller population control issues and the whole Bush scam with the bioterrorism. So get on www.tetrahedron.org, and if you have problems, call 888-508-4787. That's 888-508-4787.
And what time will that be up there, do you think?
Well, I'm hoping by mid-afternoon we should have it up, along with a press release. It tells you the story about Country Joe and myself and the work that we're doing now, and how it's linked to the Amnesty International.
All right, God bless you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, brother. I love you.
Fascinating hour. It just flew by. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that was Dr. Len Horowitz, and I hope you enjoyed the program. And unfortunately, somebody took our server down, so we lost some of the internet coverage. But at least here on the central coast of California, you've got this. And this is, I think, was a great, great hour. So pray for America. Pray for a revival in America. Pray for our leaders. Pray for our ministers who should have the courage to speak out on these issues. And please remember to pray for my ministry, our ministry, your ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.